look at this particular symposium as one of not only history, but also African governments, as has been advertised. And to that extent, I'm not so much going to talk about the American experience as I am going to make a few comments about what I feel to be the responsibility of every African scholar. And one of those responsibilities, I feel, is to make some critical comments about the objective political situation in which we as African people find ourselves. To that extent, I would like to relate my comments here to the question of U.S. foreign policy and its relationship to Southern Africa, speaking generally about U.S. foreign policy and its relation to Africa. In 1972 or thereabouts, the administration of Richard Nixon in the United States developed a memorandum in the National Security Council. This memorandum was revealed to the public by the newspapers in 1975. It became known as National Security Council Memorandum Number 39, or NISM 39. NISM 39 was important in that it exposed to the world, for the first time, the written basis for U.S. foreign policy in Africa in the Richard Nixon administration. Put very simply, this particular policy went by the name of Tar Baby. Tar Baby, in quotes. And the nub of the policy was to draw much closer to South Africa and the particular white regime to Southern Africa in a policy of exchange and a policy of cooperation. This was predicated on the fact that the African revolutionary movements presently operative in Southern Africa would not succeed, and therefore the only route to peace lay through an accommodation with the white regimes, the racist white regimes of Southern Africa. Now, this particular policy has been attempted to be operationalized. And in 1974, President Ford ordered a review of U.S. policy toward Africa. In September 1975, Henry Kissinger stated that the broad goals of policy were directed toward making the African continent free of great power conflict, fostering self-determination, and having Africa take its place as a strong member of the international economic order. Now, this sounds very fine. At the same time, however, we understand that this was precisely when the United States launched a policy of intervention in Angola, a policy which saw the United States, through the Central Intelligence Agency, funnel funds to UNITA, funnel funds through FNLA, and in an attempt to influence the outcome of that revolutionary struggle. Thus we see that while the United States, on the one hand, through Secretary Kissinger, was enunciating a policy of which appeared on its face to be progressive, with the other hand, we were intervening in the politics of Southern Africa. We weren't intervening alone. The South African government, through its troops, were intervening on the side of UNITA in Angola. By what Daniel Patrick Moynihan, U.S. representative to the United Nations, called a simple convergence of policy. Well, there are those who do not look at this as a simple or a mere convergence of policy, but a calculated attempt on the part of the government to use South Africa as an instrument of American policy in that particular region. I think we should remember that this is a new phase of the relationship between the United States and South Africa, using one as the instrument of the politics of the other. And I think we ought to see, therefore, the new U.S. foreign policy enunciated by Secretary Kissinger in Lusaka in this particular light. I was going to make a short analysis of the Lusaka policy. I will not do so. I think for those who want to do that, they can, want to hear that, they can look at my paper. I would like to go toward the end of this paper and simply say that if we return to our thesis that the United States is using or attempting to use South Africa as an instrument of its own policy, I think what we have to look at is that the trip to the African continent, together with a subsequent trip to West Germany for talks with Voerster, indicated that it will not be easy to legitimize the South African regime, despite the covert contact which exists between it and black states. South Africa has been isolated from normal international relations, both inside and outside the African continent, and its policy of detente could not succeed. But in order for the thrust of U.S. policy of peaceful negotiations to succeed, the South Africans must be able to normalize relations to succeed with a wide range of African states. And in exchange, the United States appears to be in a position to offer them some incentives. Since Kissinger also mentions that in the immediate future, the United States was prepared to triple its assistance to selected African states. The fact here is that we ask the question, what is the basis of this particular use of Southern Africa in that particular way? Well, Secondary Kissinger, when he returned from Lusaka, made a statement before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee was very eager to know why this Lusaka declaration. He was very candid. He said, point one, the United States wanted to avoid a race war, which would have inevitably tragic consequences for all concerned. Number two, the United States wanted to do all we can to prevent foreign intervention in what must remain African problems. Number three, the United States wanted to promote peaceful cooperation among the communities of Southern Africa. And number four, the United States wanted to prevent radicalization of Africa. And there I think we have the key. The new alliance between the United States and South Africa is geared to prevent the further radicalization of those states in Southern Africa who are now adopting in their midst revolutionary African movements. I think, therefore, in light of what we see to be developing a closer relationship, this is a counter-revolutionary policy on its face. And I think that glad that the American delegation let me say this, and Mr. Chairman let me have this opportunity to do it, because I think that this is one of the responsibilities of, as I said, of every African scholar to criticize this particular regime if they appear to be wrong.
Dr. Mark Werfel is going to be next.
Yes, Mr. Chairperson. I have a paper here on black studies in the USA, but the logic and substance of this conference requires that I read some brief remarks written only last night. This too represents what we mean by black studies. Comrades, colleagues, and friends, I greet you on behalf of the Afro-American liberation struggle, a struggle which is merging with the workers' movement and all oppressed national minorities in the United States in a fighting united front against imperialism, a struggle whose aim is national liberation and socialist revolution, a struggle united with the countries, nations, and peoples of the world in their heroic fight for independence, liberation, and revolution. My first point concerns history. We fight over history because the ruling class has consciously distorted it to enslave our minds. We ask, what is the logic and substance of our historical process? Black people have struggled through three major stages of historical experience in the United States since the Atlantic slave trade. Blacks were held as chattel slaves in a system of production and social life that was an antiquated, barbaric anomaly inside a growing industrial capitalist system. It represented the backward state of the slave mode of production and the vicious exploitation of capitalism's profit greed. After the Civil War in the 1860s, the quality of life changed little, but there was a profound change in the relations of production. Black people were transformed into a quasi-feudal people, and this represented the initial possibility for the formation of an Afro-American nation. Outright fascist terror ruled, and production was characterized by nearly forced labor. World War I and World War II pulled blacks out of the rural southern farms into the industrial northern cities. Now over 90% of all black people in the United States are wage workers, a solid part of the working class in the United States. Briefly, this periodization of our historical development in the heart of one of the world's most dangerous imperialist forces is a major step in our historical consciousness, as it clearly points out our task as solid sector of the proletariat in the United States, our task as socialist revolution. While our cultural life has dialectically progressed in this same manner, we know that it is the political economy and the role of the state that controls and dominates our life that is in fact the most important consideration. Prior to the Civil War in the 1860s, it was possible for revolutionaries to have a strategy for a two-stage revolution. First, the destruction of the slave system, and second, the ultimate goal of the destruction of the capitalist system. But this did not happen. This is not what occurred. What did occur is the continuation of the bourgeois democratic revolution begun over 100 years previously, called the American Revolution. And the function of this was to further consolidate the rule of northern industrial capital over the entire country. Now, after decades of struggle, after the revolutionary upsurge of the 1960s, we face squarely and courageously the fight for socialism. As Afro-Americans, we are a people who have at least two historical tasks central to our role in this colloquium and festival. First, the rediscovery and reaffirmation of our ancestral past to celebrate our African origins and our continuing struggle for survival in the belly of the beast of U.S. imperialism. In this regard, we reach out to the masses of our African sisters and brothers. Secondly, and however, the most important task is to affirm our unity with all oppressed and suffering masses of the world, to merge our struggle with the proletariat in our own country and fight a revolutionary struggle. So the main question facing Afro-American people in the United States is the unity required for socialist revolution in the United States. Moreover, we feel that while this is a festival of art and culture, the main point of unity that can and must be reached is a fighting unity against imperialism. This is the lesson of the heroic struggle of PAIGC and the fallen great hero Amilcar Cabral. This is the lesson of Guinea. But also it's a lesson of Paul Robeson, of Claude McKay and Langston Hughes and many other men and women of culture that have emerged in the struggle, the long and heroic struggle of the Afro-American people. So I conclude these brief remarks by placing a challenge before this working group and before the entire conference, the entire colloquium, the entire festival. Can we place this struggle against imperialism at the heart of our final summary report, our message to the world, and define this struggle as the basis for creating a new world? And this, of course, means a new Africa. To quote an African leader, if you want a revolutionary culture, create the revolution, and the people will create the culture. Long live the unity of the peoples of the world. Unite against imperialism. Long live the African Revolution.
The gathering has shown its appreciation. The gathering has shown its appreciation for the clear and far-sighted address that we just had, and I want to thank Dr. McWhorter on your behalf. I now turn to Dr. Karenga, who is going to sort of speak to us for another 10 minutes before our brother from Guinea.
One of the most, first I would like to say we appreciate the honor of speaking before this great body. We appreciate the contacts and communication we have with sisters and brothers around the world. And as I said in another lecture that I gave, we come not to celebrate black, but rather to understand it and unite with those people who share our aspirations, both in class and culture terms. And so that we would like to say again that we are glad to be here, and we're here for an understanding of what all of us are about. And to that end, I would not discuss the whole world, but rather concentrate on that part of the world from which I come, because I believe that my first duty, if I am to bring the world closer to revolution and reconstruction, is to make revolution and reconstruct the society in which I find myself. The means by which we have done that is try to make a synthesis between nationalism and socialism. And what we want to talk about is such a struggle that we wage now. We talk about Afro-American nationalism as a social strategy and struggle for community. We talk about it as being national conscious and national commitment that is informed by a socialist understanding of ourselves and the world. There are some problems in discussing Afro-American nationalism. It's easy to talk about Somali nationalism. It's easy to talk about Ghanaian nationalism. It's easy to talk about Cuban nationalism, or take nationalism away and put patriotism in front of it. And people, because revolutions have been won in those countries, will say, that's right, I understand it. But Afro-Americans still have to impose themselves on the world. Still they have to justify their concepts. Still they have to make the world understand why we speak a certain way, why we are so concerned with the question of color. Why do we talk in terms of black? That is what the world wants to know. Certainly if we said class, everybody would clap. That is socially aware and socially committed. But when we explain the second half of the dual character of our society and therefore the dual character of our structure, people begin to wonder, people begin to question, and I'm here to exchange dialogue and try to get at the heart of that question. We have no final solutions, as I've said before. Everything we do is proved in the end by practice, or disproved by practice. We have the problems with explaining Afro-American nationalism because of the general hostility to nationalism. And that comes from four basic problems. Number one, people usually project the pathologies of nationalism as the model of nationalism. When they think of nationalism, what do they think about? Not patriotic activity, defending a people and a country, but what? Nazism, fascism, and they bring it out as if that were nationalism. That is as idiotic and as harmful to clarity as saying that socialists who claim to be socialists are the model of socialists regardless of what they're doing. And taking the worst practices that are committed or carried out in the name of socialism and then saying that's socialism. The second problem is not only the projection of pathology, but the academic hostility to anything that sounds like ideology or what is finally termed rhetoric. Third is the perception that by posing nationalism, you in fact pose human diversity, which people feel is a source of human division rather than human richness. We believe that human diversity is not human division. That's not the source of human division. The source of human division is a class that has had the power and the motive to divide the world. It's not simply different cultures, different countries. It's a class that rules the world that has found it important to divide the world. Human diversity. Human diversity is human richness. The fourth problem we have is a theoretical clumsiness that confuses the nationalism of an oppressor nation with the nationalism of an oppressed nationality. The nationalism of oppressor nation is wrong and has to be condemned. But the nationalism of an oppressed nationality or nation is a liberational project and must be supported. To understand Afro-American nationalism thus is not only to do us a favor, but it is one to understand a very persistent socio-historical force and form of social consciousness that just won't go away because you don't like it. Second, it is to understand an aspect of humanity and through that to understand the whole of humanity. And third, it is to understand a key people in a key country whose liberation, as I've said before, would not only mean that it frees that people and that country from the grotesque grasp of capitalism and racism, but will thus bring the whole of humanity closer to full and final liberation. And that is why we present our case. What is this nationalism? How does it express itself? Why did it come into being? Why do we see things in color terms? First, as I said, nationalism is an ideological formulation. It is first reactive and then proactive. It is a reaction like Guinea, like Somalia, like Cuba, like everybody else that has ever run into racism. It is a reaction that says defiantly, I accept what I am. I reject your interpretation of me. I will redefine reality in my own image and shape my future as I see it according to my needs. And because black people have been represented by the wrong people, because usually they are represented by the State Department or by idiots from the State Department, people begin to believe that that was the line we're pushing. No, it's not. The brother that spoke before me spoke seriously. There is, in fact, a struggle going on in the country. Everybody does not agree with the official line that comes from the government. We are here to say we stand in unity with our class as well as culture allies, and we want you to know that it is important for you not to try to dismiss us, but try to understand us, and in fact, if our struggle is just, which we know it is, dare to support us. And people are actually afraid to intervene in America. And they use all kinds of international rules not to do it. America is a great challenge to the world. People might not like it, but they're not ready to challenge it. And we black people have in fact challenged it. And we black people will challenge it in even more effective ways. So I'm talking again about the national liberation struggle. And I have said that it is first an ideological formulation. It is first defensive and reactive, but then it must become developmental. That is where it of necessity takes on a socialist awareness. It cannot just react, it cannot just protest, but it must plan and it must project and make relationships with other oppressed and exploited people. And so one of the principles of that nationalism is the unity and struggle of all oppressed and progressive people. Historically, nationalism came into being, I said, as a counter to racism. Racism is not just an attitude. People sit in this hall and they talk as if racism is just an attitude. No, that's racial prejudice. Racism is a practice as well as an ideology. It expresses itself on three basic levels. First, it is imposition, a historical act of conquest and control, of usurping a people's history and making it a footnote or wiping it out, making a footnote in European history or wiping it out together. Second, racism is an ideology, an elaborate set of pseudo-scientific lies to justify oppression, to justify the defamation and denial of a people's history. And third, racism is an institutional arrangement that seeks to reinforce and perpetuate that kind of imposition. So this is what we then begin to fight against. And that gives us the second point of nationalism, that it is a social corrective, social strategy and program to actually end the evils and injustices imposed on our lives. The building of alternative institutions. First and foremost, the construction of an alternative power that seeks to change society, that seeks an alliance with other oppressed and progressive people to actually change the character and course of America. And finally, nationalism is a collective vocation. Every people needs a social purpose. It's not enough to have an individual purpose. We must link our purpose always to greater social goals, and we believe, therefore, that the nationalism we represent does in fact do that. Give black people a great overriding social purpose. Puts them in contact with the rest of the world. We are not isolationists, but we said it and we say it again. Only a people can save itself, and a people that cannot save itself is lost forever. That is how I would like to close. Thank you for listening.
After that applause, brothers and sisters, my thanking Brother Karin that on your behalf is really superfluous. And I must say how sort of pleased we were to hear what he has to say, and no doubt we will want to sort of speak to that matter in the subsequent discussion. Our last speaker now is... Our last speaker now is a brother from Guinea. And he will be speaking. He is Sanusi from Guinea, and he will be speaking for 15 minutes on African civilization and historical consciousness. And then we will have our break. Now we have a situation. It's now 20 to 6. Now, what I was going to propose, if that's agreeable to you, is that we sort of take the discussion now and break as quickly as possible, rather than stopping now and attempting to reconvene again. Is that satisfactory? Right. Yeah. On the understanding that we will be completing the around about 6 o'clock, so we have 15 minutes. Okay. May I have questions from the floor, please? May I see hands of people who want to speak first? All right. Well, could I go around the room? Yes, could I have your name and country?
The name is Ruth Okuhuna, USA.
Yes. Yes.
Lionel Jeffrey, UK.
Right.
Okay, shall we start? Yes?
Cuba.
Cuba.
Senegal.
All right. Shall we? Am I missing some people? Sorry, that modern technology is against me. It's my eye. I can't see your hand.
Put your hand like this.
All right, Somalia. Yeah? Anybody else? No. Okay. Could I ask you, if I may, to restrict your comments and questions to 2 minutes as a maximum? Because we have a rather long list of people in front of us and the platform. I will take all the questions and then I'll ask the platform to reply at the end. The lady from the United States, your name is? Well, you have the floor.
Thank you.
Next, because I want to take my notes. Okay.
question. I'm not exactly, but I'm just wondering, do you have any idea as to how we are going to go about resolving the problem? Although it is true that there are a number of Black Americans who have come to this country, and they have been involved in this various CIA episodes that we don't want to go into at the moment. But the thing about it is now, the minute that somebody, even in my own case, you know, the minute that they hear Nigerians, most of them hear an American accent, they don't want any part of you because they just now automatically assume that if you're halfway Israeli, then you must be a CIA plant. Now, I'm just wondering, what do you think that we're going to do, and what can we do about that? Are you having ideas? Are you even aware of the fact that most Africans feel that Black Americans, that you stay away from these Black American collections because they're just here making noise, you know, they're really not serious about it. They're just trying to get to become very close to the other Africans so that they can get into their various secrets and various ways of the government. Now, what do you think, I mean, what exactly, do you have any ideas about how we're going to resolve this problem?
Okay, thank you. Ethiopia, I'm going to sort of interpolate a question from Ethiopia, because my rapporteur on my right hand, he has a sort of record, so he wants to get his question in early so he can go back to record it. You have the floor,
yes.
Mr. Rapporteur.
Thanks so much. I found this afternoon's discussion most interesting, because several points that were omitted in the last discussion were raised, especially in on the question of relating the African fight to the fight of the oppressed classes and the fight for socialism. And as one speaker said, I don't think that one could really separate racism from capitalism, and it is in many ways the capitalist system that is perpetuating racism all over the world. The question that has just been raised shows that just because you are black, it does not mean that you are revolutionary.
Yeah.
And just because you are white, it does not mean you are a reactionary. Blacks have become CIA agents, and whites have become revolutionaries to fight for the cause of the Africans. And I think the only solution to avoid Africans suspecting Black Americans becoming CIA agents is to fight the American capitalist system, and there is no other way to it. Another point that was of interest was that there was really no point of speaking about Black civilization, because civilization has no color. It depends on the material production of whoever creates it, Black or white, and it's not because you are Black that create a Black civilization. A white man under the same material production will create the same civilization. So the title of Black civilization to this festival has really no sense. The question of the return of the Black diaspora, as you call it, the Black Africans outside to Africa, has again no sense to me if it is just for the return. In Africa we have now exploiting regimes, capitalist regimes, feudal regimes, corrupt regimes. If you are coming to be an instrument of these regimes, I don't think there is any need for Africa for you to come back to Africa. If you are coming to fight with the revolutionaries in every regime, as well as in the south of Africa, in all the oppressed and colonial regimes, then you are welcome. Finally, this morning, another remark was made by a Canadian delegate. I thought he talked of a laboratory where blacks were given lessons on black consciousness. I think this again does not make any sense. If you really want to create consciousness, you have to enter yourself in all the revolutionary struggles in Britain, America, and Canada, and encourage especially the uneducated blacks in these countries to join the revolutionary struggle with all the oppressed classes of these three countries. And I would like to know on this point what measures you have taken, what steps what progress you have made in your alliance with the proletariat in Great Britain, US and Canada. I know that in these countries they tell you there are no proletariats, they are all white collars, they are not exploited and you cannot join with them. And every time there is a crisis, the capitalist rulers, they tell them they cannot, the cause are the blacks who have taken all your employment and so on, and they are trying to divide the black exploited classes and the proletariat. But this is no reason for not aligning and for not working with the proletariat in all these countries. And I would like to know what measures have been taken, what progress have been made in your alliance with the proletariat in the three countries.
Thank you. The delegate from Guinea, not Guinea, I beg your pardon, Nigeria. You have the floor, sir.
What block?
We know that China is socialist and that they have problems of ethnicity. We know they are nationalist also. So the question really is not so much that there's a contradiction between both of them, but to in fact look at what is spoken for in terms of nationalism. I think the real problem lies between racialism and socialism. And in this regard, that it's very important to see that how the black is defined, whether in the Afro-American sense or in the Nigerian sense, that is moving towards black nationalism. If the unit of membership is a citizen, then we would like to know exactly what is the weight of the citizen, what is the value attached to that citizen, insofar as that citizen of, you know, exists within a hierarchical relationship, and that's a system, then black has to be interpreted to be each class status within that system. So the question becomes then, when you are living in a multi-racial society, how does a racial group in itself pose itself as a contradiction to that state system, define itself vis-a-vis the state itself, and within its own community? That's one with the man. I would like to ask myself to the Wallace. I think the question now, a policy, you don't mention the Nixon policy, the first policy towards South Africa. I'm wondering whether or not with the emergence of Carter, does he see a continuation of that policy? Or is there in fact a crisis of no policy? And if there is no policy towards South Africa, what are we going to do in terms of African American and in terms of the Afro-American or the black group in diaspora to formulate an African policy and send it both to the US and to the African
Thank you. The delegate from the UK. Mr. Jeffrey, you have the floor.
Chairman, I would like to address my delegates from the US. I would first like to say how very pleased I was to hear Second Speaker Anthony Paul Robinson, thanks to Jews and Adam Woodwall, because for years in my business, source of sorrow for us, the death comes in many parts of the world. We hear the black Americans speak for hours and not recognize the contributions of a man like Paul Robeson. It is a great pleasure to me at this time in life to hear the people of the U.S. mention these men. Having said that, you know where I'm coming from. I'm also very pleased in there, recognizing the reality of the American situation, historical development of society. It is inevitable that you have an approach to the racial question, to the plant question, which was difficult myself when I started to live in. Nevertheless, they seem to have been in a struggle now, not so much as a internalized struggle only, but as linking it with the oppressed people from all parts of the world. This to me is an interesting development, and I hope it's a prominent one. The question I want to address to you is a very simple one. We have lived through a period in the American struggle, which is known as the Black Power period. It came to the UK like fire, and ran right through our political organizations, with kind of shock attack.
characteristics and latent characteristics. What it has left to create through at this period, not that I'm taking it over, not to different. You don't say that it is not what used to be perhaps 7 years ago.
Thank you. The delegate from Canada. You have the floor, sir. Name?
Yes.
Yes, you have the floor. Thank you. Delegate from Zaire. Name, please. You have the floor.
Got it now. Thank you.